Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host Gina... I was going to say Gina Davis, but it's actually Gina Radcliffe.
I'm sorry you had to settle for me. I understand that that's a disappointment, but I'll do the best I can.
Well, Gina, please reintroduce yourself to my audience and explain where else they might hear you.
I am the co-host of the Kill by Kill podcast, in which we talk about horror movies according to the characters. And I also write about movies and television at thespool.net, which probably has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about today.
This time we're going a little bit different. We are going with the Beats. We're specifically going to talk about a poem each by Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. We can talk about the Beats more generally, too, if you like. Gina, this was a topic you were interested in.
Yeah, I went through a phase, as a lot of people do, with the writing of the Beat Generation. I'm a little bit embarrassed to say now that I have a tattoo inspired by On the Road. You know, people ask about it whenever they see it, and I give the whole "I was young and dumb" excuse for it, but I was probably a little older than I should have been by the time I got it. I mostly went through it in college and my early 20s, probably around the same time I went through my Charles Bukowski phase and my Hunter S. Thompson phase and all of those where you think back later, it's like, my judgment was a little cloudy back then.
Obviously, these were major literary figures of the baby boom.
Right.
Gina, you and I are both Gen X, right?
Right.
We are supposed to reject the baby boom entirely, according to the popular press. But you know, I have a copy of the portable Beats that I've dipped into from time to time. Most people out there are familiar with the terms Beats or Beatniks. It's a kind of a squishy term, and it's a kind of a squishy group. There's definitely a core group that you can point to that were contemporaries and friends, and who published and performed together. And then, you know, people like to lump in people like Bob Dylan with the Beats or whatever.
Right.
And
you've got the two core members, most likely Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. And I think them and William S. Burroughs are the writers and members of the group that people would be most familiar with. I mean, even people who don't really know much about the Beat Generation have a vague idea who Jack Kerouac was. Allen Ginsberg was a figure, prominent figure as far as late into the 1990s. There were pictures of him with like Kurt Cobain and people like that. He was still very present and considered a figure of what's, quote unquote cool, even when he was into his 60s and 70s. And I mean, of course, one of the things now that he would be, quote unquote, canceled by the younger generation is because he was apparently a proponent of NAMBLA, which is kind of a little something that you kind of have to put aside and focus on. Okay, is his writing still valuable and worth learning about when it comes to American literature? You kind of have to ignore that aspect of it. But he was, one of a few writers who was very open, graphically open about his sexuality, which was something you didn't see particularly in poetry. You did not see people just basically talking about gay sex and you know, genitals and you know, kind of looping it all together and making all this sort of fever dream. And then you have Jack Kerouac, who, but what he's probably best known for at this point, besides On the Road, is being ridiculously good looking. I found a picture of him. I was going over the poem you chose for us to talk about, and there was a picture of him when he was in The Merchant Marine, and he looked like John Hamm. It was kind of weird. If he had not been a poet, he could have been an actor. And again, that was just something, you know, unusual in literature. They are all very intent on sort of pushing against, you know, the norms of poetry and the structure of poetry. And then you have, as I mentioned earlier, William S. Burroughs, who you brought up that the Beats were sort of the poets of the baby boomer generation. And yeah, because my dad actually was the first person to introduce me to the writing of the Beats. So he was very big. He had a lot of first editions of their books, and I have held on to them since he has passed away. So yeah, this is something I got from him. He particularly liked Burroughs, which is so aggressively weird and off-putting and out there that it's just, you know, you have to understand, you know, getting into reading his books is not a particularly enjoyable experience, but it's always interesting. Where I think that out of the three, Ginsberg is probably the most, what's the word I'm looking for? Like
approachable.
Thank you. Goodness, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah.
The Beats, to the extent that they were a cohesive group, and they were a cohesive group, but they didn't start out thinking of themselves as the Beats or thinking of themselves as necessarily having a cohesive aesthetic, so much as they were a group of contemporaries who met at Columbia University,
right,
and who became greatly associated with the Greenwich Village culture of the late 50s, early 60s. The poems we're reading today are from the late 50s, and they were young writers who were reacting to the fact that America had just come through World War II on top of the world, and capitalism was taking over everything, and the looming specter of nuclear annihilation was everywhere.
Right, and they took a lot of things in their own lives or observations that they made and sort of made it into this stream of consciousness sort of poetry. Like one of Kerouac's lesser known stories, it was actually not even published until some years ago, was a story he had collaborated on with William S. Burroughs called, I want to say, and the rhinoceros cooked in its tank. I believe that's what it's called. Which is, it's not even the title of it doesn't really have anything to do with the story, but it was just this term that Kerouac supposedly heard on the radio talking about the Hartford Circus Fire in the 1940s. And the hippos were boiled in their tanks. That's what it was called. Now that might have been apocryphal, but the title of that was inspired by a news story they had heard about a fire. Whereas if you read Allen Ginsberg's Howl, which is one of the poems you selected for us, there's so much in there about observations he was making and current events and you know, the insanity of what they're experiencing with, as you pointed out, the you know, the Cold War and you know, people struggling in post-World War II America. And it's just sort of all, you know, they also make it seem sort of, you know, nightmarish or dreamy and but really it's just sort of reflecting the things that they saw and heard in their everyday lives.
The Beats were also a group that, like Aldous Huxley before them, were very interested in psychoactive drugs.
Right.
The Beats were drawn to not only drug use, but to exploring the disreputable side of America.
Right.
They found the America of capitalism and of suburban development. They found it absolutely abhorrent. People like Ginsberg, celebrated the real outcasts of society, the junkies, the homosexuals of the time, which were at the time still considered to be it's a psychological disorder.
Right.
And they're also very, very interested in people of color, who, of course, this being the 50s, they called Negroes rather aggressively through a lot of their writings, which is also kind of hard sometimes when you're reading it, romanticizing and completely othering the experience of people of color. I feel always like you have to really be able to approach these things on their own terms, because reading some of these things by today's standards, they're not great.
Right, and they feel a little. They're you know, again, it's sort of very, very boomerish. You know, it's like, you know, pushing back against the system, man, and but also it's got, you know, Truman Capote famously said of Jack Kerouac's writing, "That's not writing, that's typing." Because Kerouac had a very unique, for the time, now there's a lot of writers that mimic it, of really just doing this, again, sort of stream of consciousness writing, where he was just sort of, you know, probably drunk or high at the time, just, you know, typing whatever came to the top of his mind. And sometimes it made sense, a lot of times it didn't. But I think that was a lot inspired by jazz, which, again, you know, would have exposed them to a lot of people of color. And, you know, a lot of so-called, you know, music experts did look at particularly freeform jazz as, well, this is not, they're not really playing anything, they're just, you know, blowing on a saxophone or whatever, which is kind of the same thing.
Right. This is contemporary with bebop. Bebop was notoriously intellectual, abstract, difficult to approach, and that's why the beats ate it up. In fact, the term beat, which was applied retroactively, originally came from jazz musicians, so in some ways it's a kind of an appropriation, but it was used by Jack Kerouac in one interview where he said it feels like a beat generation, meaning a tired, worn out, strung out generation. And then, because that was a very influential essay, a very influential interview, suddenly he goes back and he like really hits hard on this word. It's like this brand that he wants to use. And I know that some of the other beats were not so keen on the word, but at a certain point it stuck. And at the point where people were calling hipsters beatniks, the game was over. It was forever going to be the Beats.
Yeah, I one of my favorite cartoon panels is, I actually have a t-shirt of this. It's a Sluggo from Nancy saying that he's thinking about becoming a beatnik, and he's got like a little beret and like a little soul patch and all. And I just love, and like sunglasses, and I just love it so much. But yeah, another thing that you were saying, and I 100% agree with you, you know, despite my, you know, having gone through a phase to read them now, it comes off a little hokey. But you also have to remember, and I don't mean you specifically, you know, that these are meant to be performed. These are meant to be, you know, a spoken word rendition in front of an audience, you know, where they know the kind of how it's supposed to flow and you how what inflections are supposed to be and supposed to be applied, and it doesn't always come across in just reading it. You know, one of the only, like, Jack Kerouac did write a few novels. They're fine. They you know, were actually, other than On the Road, they're fairly straightforward. You know, he wrote a book about his childhood. He wrote a book about a you know, a trip he had taken somewhere. But they're generally pretty, you know, I'd lack of a better word, normal writing. Whereas with Burroughs, you know, he would write entire novels just of psychobabble and these, like, you know, psychedelic descriptions of things, and you know, that's, you know, basically he's like, you know, Beat Generation 202. You don't jump right in with Burroughs. You really don't.
The other thing that Kerouac did, which I think characterizes this a lot of the Beat writers, but I think it characterizes Kerouac more than any of them, is he engaged in the mythology of self. On the Road is his memoir about a trip he took. He changes all the names, God knows why, because it's just him and people, and every single person in that book has a real world equivalent. And he writes about extremely banal things. You know, he writes about travel. He writes about work. He writes about listening to music. He writes about getting high. He writes about tawdry sexual encounters. And yet he writes about them all as moments of meditation or revelation. He seems perpetually excited by life and perpetually excited by the possibilities of the people he's going to meet and the things he's going to do.
Right. And the person that he is traveling with is based on Neil Cassady, who he looked up to as the sort of person who really had no masters, or at least he perceived him as just being completely his own man and you know, just a person of the world. And you've got Ginsberg and Kerouac, who both had very conventional childhoods. They had two parents, lived in relative security. I mean, of course, you have later, as it turns out, you know, Ginsberg's mother had, had experienced mental illness. You got Kerouac, who had a brother who died very young, so his mother became very protective of him to a point where he and his mother kind of had a unhealthily close relationship. When he died relatively young, he was only in his late 40s, I believe. He spent the last part of his life living with his mother. Once he was no longer able to take care of himself because his alcohol problem was out of control. But I think that he perceived, probably inaccurately, because everybody has a master. Everybody has someone that they have to answer to in some way. Nobody is their 100%, their own person. But he would look up to people that he just perceived as being able to get up and go wherever they wanted in the world without any issues, or without having to work under a time frame, or somehow they always have enough money to get by, or they know enough people whose couches they can crash on. And for him, that, you know, was very much the ideal life, which I think, and I'm only speaking for myself here, I think that might have been why Generation X was so drawn to it initially. Because if you recall, when we were young and in our 20s, and again, I don't want to speak for you, you might have been a more responsible person.
Not at all.
You know, it seemed kind of desirable to just, traipse around the world and crash on whoever's couches and not have to worry about getting up and going to a boring old job every day and not worry about the wife and kids thing or the husband and kids thing and just doing whatever you want. And I think that we, people our age also idealize that, to a great, possibly unhealthy extent. And then, the millennials who wisely realize, okay, it costs money to do this. And you can't, that's not a lifestyle you can maintain for very long.
Something about what you said there reminded me that Kerouac For better or for worse, is also sort of a shorthand for a certain type of character.
Yeah.
To the extent that, I don't know if you remember, but in the Gilmore Girls, when Rory first meets Jess, the bad boy boyfriend, he has a copy of On the Road in his pocket.
Oh, yeah.
As I've said before in this podcast, I always love when stories tell us what the characters are reading as a shorthand for giving them a characteristic. And it's sort of like, I sort of groaned when I saw that. I was like, oh yeah,
that just tells you all. And yeah, it's sort of like, I compare it to going through a phase, and I went through this too, of thinking that people like Jim Morrison were attractive. And that sort of, you know, wild poet thing. And then you grow up a little bit and you realize, no, that's not any kind of person you want to spend a lot of time with. Definitely, that's definitely not someone you want to be in a romantic relationship with. And that, you know, that bore itself out in real life. Kerouac was not a particularly, you know, he and Ginsberg had, you know, a lot of, you know, resentment, and then you had a further issue where Ginsberg was kind of a little bit in love with Kerouac, and Kerouac was probably bisexual and very much struggling with that because he was also an old school Catholic. He was married at the end of his life, but I think that was probably maybe wife three or four at that point. And that, you know, that was kind of a symbol of the Beats overall, is that they, you know, were not much like, you know, the hippies, they still had that sort of baked in sexism where they weren't particularly, there are a few female, you know, members of the Beat generation like Joyce Johnson, but they were not particularly encouraged. They kind of were more treated as, you know, hangers-on or bed partners, or, you know, here, you know, I wrote this out, type it out for me, you know, just that kind of thing, you know, which is, you know, they were pushing back against, you know, capitalism and the man, but they still had that, you know, that baked-in sexism.
Right, right. They definitely had a sense of masculinity that ran through these things. Kerouac, because he loved what he saw as the common man in the trades, the laborer, and that we'll see that in the poem we're going to read. This, he had this romanticism of that, and Ginsberg wanted more than anything else to be Walt Whitman,
right?
In the same way that Walt Whitman oozed this kind of a very virile masculine, it was like a very vigorous sexuality. Ginsberg wanted to do that too. It was something of a sausage fest.
Yes. Exactly.
You said something earlier that I think was really important, which is, since these poems were designed to be read aloud as the primary form of distribution, sometimes it's hard to point to a specific version of the poem and say that's the version. For example, this first poem we're going to talk about here, Jack Kerouac's October in the Railroad Earth, was originally published in the Evergreen Review in 1957, but it's far more known for its recorded version, which was recorded in an album called Poetry for the Beat Generation, with music by Steve Allen. Today, if anyone even remembers Steve Allen and the younger generation, you think of him always like, oh, he was the guy who started the Tonight Show, I guess. But Steve Allen was a crazy cat. You know, he's a weird guy who was just seemed to be there at the right moment and did a lot of stuff. And one of the things he did was play piano on this album with Jack Kerouac. For copyright reasons, I'm not going to play any of it on this podcast, but rest assured, you can go to YouTube and find 12 copies of this if you want to hear Jack Kerouac reading October in the Railroad Earth. And to be honest, that's probably the way you want to experience this poem.
Yeah, because it just sounds like he's sort of just rattling it off the top of his head, and it's actually pretty impressive sounding.
Kerouac in 1954, moved all the way across the country on a whim because he wanted to go work on the railroads in San Francisco. Kerouac had was actually a local to me. He's from Lowell, Massachusetts, had been living in New York, and just packed it up and decided to go work on the railroad, which, yeah, makes perfect sense if you're Jack Kerouac. And this poem is a freeform poem about working. It's hard even to say what this is a poem about. You know, it starts out being something of a hymn to San Francisco, and then it talks a little bit about the realities of working on the railroad and whether or not and how it compares to other jobs you might have. And then it suddenly breaks into this aggressive present tense story where Kerouac talks about incidents from his life in San Francisco. An incident where a bum falls into a hole in the ground and we never quite find out what happens to that guy. Or an incident where he goes to a bar and gets hit on by this woman who may or may not be a prostitute, and then gets into a bar fight and gets ejected from the bar. And then it abruptly ends.
Yeah, he's just like sort of... And I feel like this is all, you know, pretty much stuff that he actually... You observed and just sort of, you know, took it all in like a sponge, and then kind of, you know, maybe you stirred it around a little bit and, you know, put it back out again.
As I listened to it, and I've listened to it a few times for this podcast, simply because I'm trying really hard to think what the through line of this poem is. It's one of these things that sounds artless, but is extremely carefully constructed, and there's several points in this poem that it reminds me strongly of Dylan Thomas. Dylan Thomas, particularly in Under Milkwood, which was his radio play about a small Welsh town. In that play, you had an omniscient narrator talking about the life in the small town, and then suddenly you're invited to be pulled into this moment. And there was, I'll try and find the line. You talk for a while.
I'm just like reading over it and I'm noticing how he's just got these random sort of nonsense words like, you know, "and all wondrous knowing about the Negro, the essential American out there always finding his solace, his meaning in the fellaheen street." And fellaheen, which he spells F-E-L-L-A-H-E-E-N. I have no idea what that means. It's just, it means something to him, which I think is, you know, fascinating. And it's probably one of those things where, you know, any possible, you know, definition you could apply to it probably could be correct.
Here's the line that reminded me most of Under Milkwood. We've had this lovely long discussion of San Francisco, but it was that beautiful cut of clouds I could always see above the little SP alley, puffs floating by from Oakland or the gate of Marin to the north or San Jose south, the clarity of Cal to break your heart. It was the fantastic drowse and drum hum of lum mum afternoon, nothing to do, old Frisco with end of land sadness. And then it goes into this line, "Now it's night in Third Street. The keen little neons and also the yellow bulb lights of the impossible to believe flops." And it's that pull from this extremely abstract God's eye view to this moment, and this moment existing in present tense. That's what reminds me so much of Thomas. As I just sit here and describe this poem to people who haven't heard it, it must sound like just a jumbled mess. And in some ways, it is a jumbled mess if you try to read it just without speaking it aloud. But it works very well as a spoken piece.
Well, I think that the particularly the the kind of jarring change in, well, here's, you know, a peaceful description of the beauty of San Francisco in the daytime to, you know, oh, he's in, like, you know, the red light district or Skid Row or whatever you want to call it, the sketchy part of town, let's say. And he really just sort of gets that frenetic, taking in the sound of other people talking and arguing with each other. And then the idea of, you know, you're sitting at a bar and just some random person just comes up and starts talking to you about their problems that you've never met this person in your life before, but they just need someone to talk to. And just, and he's getting more and more intoxicated, which means that, you know, as we're going on, things are making less and less sense. I mean, it does feel like someone who's, you know, sort of, you know, after a hard day's of work, you know, is celebrated by getting absolutely plotzed at a bar and just jotting down all the weird shit that he sees.
It just sort of devolves at the end into this crazy drunken stupor as he's getting into a fight. And we never really find out what the fight was about. And he's getting thrown out. And he's regretting the fact that he didn't take this woman up on her sexual come on. It's such an odd thing to kind of end on. But that's Kerouac. He's not going to talk about what would normally be considered a fit subject for a poem. Or, you know, at least a passage in his life where something changed or something profound happened. This is in some ways the most banal story you can tell, and it doesn't really have a point.
Right, but by the time you look at the end of the poem, like literally the last word, it just sounds like nonsense. He just like almost like the written word version of slurring. Whereas to compare him to, say, Bukowski, who's obviously very much influenced by the Beats, and you know, a lot of his writing focused on just being a drunk and the, you know, the shenanigans, let's say, of that he would get into because he was, you know, he such a heavy drinker. But he didn't write in this sort of almost whimsical sort of, you know, here's all the weird stuff that I'm hearing and hallucinating because I've drank too much. His Bukowski was very stark and unpleasant in his descriptions of the things he got into when he was drinking, where Kerouac almost made it seem a little fun, a little artsy. And again, I think that was another draw for young people, the next generation, is wouldn't we all like to get drunk and be able to write a beautiful poem? And instead, you know, most of us can't even do that sober, let alone drunk, trying to write a stream of consciousness poem that is sort of lovely in its absolute, you know, nonsense.
I have an ulterior motive for bringing this poem up. People who know me know I have a great love for the radio plays of ZBS, the hippie production company that started in 1968 and produced these fantasies that ran on public radio in the 70s and 80s, most starring Jack Flanders. And it was in the second Jack Flanders series, Moon Over Morocco, that I first heard an excerpt of this poem. And I did not know what it was. And it stuck with me over many, many years. And then many, many years later, I found out what it was. And I thought, oh, yeah. So we all come to literature in different ways. So from probably a lesser known poem, but I do recommend it partly because there is this wonderful recording out there that you can listen to. And you can listen to in the course of about 10 minutes, so it's worth looking up. Let's turn to probably the most famous of all Beat poems, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, which is probably mostly famous for its first line, which is one of the most parodied first lines in literature.
Hal had a lot of meaning to me because I feel it was probably one of the first poems, and I'm not particularly well versed in poetry, so please, by all means, if you know for certain, correct me if I'm wrong. I feel like it's one of the first poems that directly addresses mental illness and the, you know, the just the experience of being a mentally ill person. And it feels like, and again, this one reads better than the Kerouac poem does. It's not, for one thing, it's not just a wall of text. It is basically arranged in a way that is, you can read it and not get lost in it, but it is better hearing it performed. But it's basically, it sort of feels like just you the ranting of someone desperately trying to hold their sanity together.
As with Kerouac, I think that there is a lot of mythologizing going on, self-mythologizing here. Ginsberg is taking what a lot of people would see as a shameful or, you know, taboo subject, the fact that he had spent some time in a psychiatric ward, and making it into this moment of euphoric reverie about the state of the country and the people he knows and the generation he loves. And again, this is the poem by him that I think is the most imitating Whitman, with these long rumbling lines that spill one into another. And the way that he takes the personal and his personal ego and translates it into a stand-in for the experience of all America. And there is a segment in the middle of the poem where he jumps from location to location in America, enumerating the various states and the various people in those states. And that is, again, right out of Song of Myself from Whitman. Whitman does exactly the same thing in his 16th section of that poem.
Right. It sort of starts out with, you know, it feels like, you know, what various people ended up in mental hospitals for back in the 50s, like being gay. You know, a lot. He makes reference to people being you know, arrested for having sex in parks with, you know, presumably other men. You know, people who were, you know, alcoholics or drug addicts, or just, you know, people having delusions and maybe writing about those delusions or trying to express them artistically, and instead of people, you know, accepting that that was how they were going to express what they were feeling, they just put them in a mental hospital. It just sort of gives you an idea of how easy it was for a person who was the slightest bit outside the norm to be institutionalized, either by their parents or by the state, just for something as a, you know, benign today as you know, engaging in homosexual sex or writing a weird poem that, you know, somebody may not quite understand, and it may sound a little scary to them, but it's just something that a person wanted to write that they needed to just, you know, get out of their system. You know, the vast majority of people who, you know, even today end up in psychiatric hospitals are not violent people. You know, if they're a danger to anybody, it's mostly to themselves. But, you know, if you stuck a toe outside the box of, you know, normality, you know, off you went, you know, and you had to prove to yourself that you were going to act like a normal person, for whatever that meant, before you got out.
The first section of Hal, the longest section and probably the most famous section, is notable for being a single sentence, technically. it starts with the well-known, "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night. Who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz." And most of the next, I don't know how many verses there are on this, I would say probably about 200 verses, begin with the word "who," and it's continuing this, repeated pronoun of "who," which one, you know, technically is referring back to the best minds of his generation. It's starting to explode outwards into a cacophonous enumeration of almost everybody in the country. So Ginsberg is playing this. I relate everything he does to Whitman. He's playing this game of the poet standing in as the observer and the mediator and the channeler of this entire generation of people. It's a great act of ego, but it's you know, a lot of I think it's very affecting.
Yeah, one line that I'm looking at right now that I always particularly loved was "who cut their wrists three times successively, unsuccessfully, gave up and were forced to open antique stores. They thought they were growing old and cried." And I just that to me, out of the whole poem, that's probably the most straightforward line. He used a lot of metaphor. He used a lot of sexualized language. But for that, to me, that is the most gripping and moving line. Other than my favorite section is the third section, which is repeating, "I'm with you in Rockland," which is basically a message directly to Carl Solomon, who the poem is dedicated to. And Carl Solomon was someone he had met while they were both staying at a psychiatric hospital together. And it's sort of we're apart now, but you know, I'm with you, I'm thinking of you, you know, and you know, I understand how hard it is for you out here.
The third section, the address to Carl Solomon, uses much shorter lines and is much gentler in a way. It's like all the bombast of the first section is gone, but on the other hand, he's talking touchingly about the trauma of being in a mental ward. He makes something very beautiful about that. We shouldn't overlook the second section, the Moloch section. Moloch being the false god of the Hittites mentioned in the Bible. False if you are an Israelite. So I don't want to offend my ancient Hittite listeners. But Moloch is the symbol here of the country and capitalism and the systems that are trying to make people into model citizens. Again, as we've said before, the beats were very big on sticking it to the man.
Yeah, this one, this section in particular, it takes on a whole new feeling when you hear it performed, because Ginsberg really got into it. Kerouac kind of more sort of rattled things off, and again, it sounded more like he was sort of talking off the top of his head and improvising as he went along. But for Ginsberg, it was a performance. He was just shouting to the back of the theater.
It's interesting that there's a fourth section that is sometimes just pushed in with Howell, and sometimes it's presented as a separate poem. I gather it wasn't in the original printed version, but then it was added. It was called A Footnote to Howl. But here's the thing. I have not done my research, and I'm just sitting here looking at the poems here on the Poetry Foundation's page, which is a great resource. I recommend everyone.
I'm looking at that exact page.
He has Howl, the writing of Howl listed as 1955 to 1956, but the footnote to Howl, which is the last section, was written in 1955. I guess maybe the idea is that he went back and he did more revision on the original poem afterwards.
Yeah, and he actually calls out some of his colleagues by name in this. Like he says, Holy Solomon, Holy Lucian, who is Lucian Carr, Holy Kerouac, Holy Hunky, Holy Burroughs, Holy Cassidy. And he mentions Holy Peter, who was Peter Orlovsky, his partner for many years. And that's as, you know, directly personal as he gets, other than the I'm with you in Rockland portion of just basically calling out. And he mentions himself, too, which I thought was interesting.
I feel like I'm a broken record here, but this is also right out of Song of Myself, where he says that every inch of himself is sacred. And that becomes in Howl, you know, the world is holy, the soul is holy, the skin is holy, the nose is holy, the tongue and cock and hand and asshole holy. It's the same, that same insistence that one shouldn't put aside certain parts of our existence and see them as shameful or as unworthy of celebration.
Right, and at that point, you never really saw poetry addressing any of that.
These aren't poems, of course, that one would have been assigned in high school, but they are probably poems that you would be assigned in an introductory poetry class in college. They are kind of difficult to approach. I've read Howl now many times in my life. I still get confused by it. I still lose my place at a certain point and have to remind myself where I am.
Yeah, as you said, it's a reverie. You just kind of got to push through it and not try to... You can't code break it. You just sort of be like, okay, I have no idea what that means, moving on to the next sentence. Because you can, you do find, you know, moments of beauty in it. You know, it's, and that's why you can't really just dismiss it as, you know, just typing or, you know, whatever, you know, terminology people would use to kind of minimize the contribution to literature. Because up to that point, no one was doing the whole automatic writing thing. And the interesting, it's very hard to do. I have tried it myself many times. And the problem is you have to really sort of turn off your inner editor that is going to say, well, don't write that. That doesn't make any sense. Where, you know, if you just went ahead and did it, you know, either you can go back and edit later or you leave it in because, well, it doesn't make any sense, but I like how it sounds. You know, I mean, which I think I feel like, because it wasn't like they just wrote all this out and said, okay, I'm ready to perform it now. They heavily edited this. They read this over. They read this to each other before they went on stage and did this. So these aren't first drafts that we're reading here. You know, this is stuff that they left in because maybe they didn't even quite know what they meant. They just liked how it sounded. And the problem a lot of people have with literature and poetry is everything has to have a concrete meaning to it. And I don't know if you can apply that. But at the same time, I don't know if you can say, well, it doesn't mean anything. It just, you know, it meant something at the time they wrote it. It meant something in their insect brain. And I think that is fascinating to read that process.
I wonder, though, about the beats. You know, I have to admit, I was kind of late in coming to them. I was not a huge fan at the time of my life that you're supposed to be a fan of the Beats, which is when I guess you're a precocious teen to being in your early 20s. And I've only kind of come back to them as I've sort of first grudgingly accepted their importance to post-war American literature, and eventually coming around to say, yeah, that's actually pretty good. As famous and beloved as Kerouac and Ginsberg are, do people really read these things? Or are they like Jesse, just keeping a paperback copy of On the Road in their back pocket?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a, you know, a thing that, I mean, and I don't even know if that's even true anymore, to be honest with you, that I don't know, you're seeing, you know, Gen Z, you know, talking about how they're reading, you know, I think that probably that has possibly been replaced with Hunter S. Thompson. You know, that's who people, you know, claim either accurately or not that they read now, to because it sounds cool to say that you read it. But yeah, I mean, you're definitely right that, I mean, I say that I have tried to read Burroughs, but the only one I was ever able to finish was Naked Lunch, which again is, even for being his most accessible book, it's really fucking weird. And his other books are just like beyond that. It's like, okay, I got through a paragraph. I have no idea what I'm reading here. I don't know. And I appreciate the audacity of that, to be honest with you, just to do his own thing and write whatever came to his mind and then manage to get it published that he didn't. And I don't think he cared in the slightest if people understood or didn't understand what he wrote. I don't think that bothered him. Whereas I would think that from what I have read about Kerouac, that he did care about that. He cared about being understood, but maybe by the right people. I think that he cared about being understood by his peers, maybe not, you know, mainstream readers. Whereas I don't think Burroughs even really was particularly interested in getting his peers' approval. I think he just kind of did his own thing. But yeah, I mean, definitely it's, they would say that it's more stuff people have said that they've read than have actually read. And yeah, I've only barely scratched the surface. I would hardly call myself an expert. And I have found that reading about the Beats is more interesting for me, at least, than reading what they wrote. Like Allen Ginsberg was a pretty interesting person, you know, support of NAMBLA aside. You know, Kerouac was a pretty interesting person because of all the kind of, you know, madness that he sort of, you know, endorsed and wrote about and celebrated. He had a very conventional life. Like he, you know, his primary issue is that he was a drunk. And again, he struggled with his sexuality, but on a day-to-day basis, you know, once he found his fame as a writer, he settled down into a very normal life. Whereas Ginsberg became a minor celebrity, well into his senior years. You know, he hung around with Johnny Depp and he hung around with people like Patti Smith and all. And, you know, I think that he was considered more of a rock star type than Kerouac was.
If a precocious youngster, let's say a teenage niece or nephew of yours, came and said, what are the Beats all about? What would you send them to read? Or would you say, you know, stick to something else?
I mean, you mentioned the Beat Reader. I think that's a Penguin collection, I think.
Right.
That's pretty good, actually. I mean, I know people don't really care for, you know, collections like that, but I think that gives you a taste and lets you know that you know, if this is going to be for you or not. I mean, On the Road is pretty accessible. I think that one is a good read and doesn't go completely off the rails in metaphor the way a lot of beat, you know, beat writing does. I think that one's still, I mean, do I, you know, can I say it still holds up? I think it still holds up, sure.
Thanks to my co-host, Gina Radcliffe. Her podcast is the Kill by Kill podcast. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Or hit me up on either Facebook or the Incomparable Membership Slack. And whatever you do, keep up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.